The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of January 29th, 2018. On this week's show, Paula Levine of ESPN's Outside the Lines will join me and Slate's Ben Mathis-Lilly to talk about her reporting on the failures of the Michigan State Athletic Department in dealing with sexual assault cases, failures that go well beyond the Larry Nassar sexual abuse case. ESPN's Howard Bryant will also be here to discuss the Australian Open, where Roger Federer won his 20th major championship, Caroline Wozniacki won her first, and Tennis Sandgren went from a fan favorite to a pariah in record time. Finally, The Root's Damon Young will help me assess the NBA's first ever All-Star draft and the seeming implosion of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Stefan Fatsis is out this week, so hopefully I won't screw this up too badly. Before we get rolling here, I want to let you know that the finale of Slow Burn, Slate's podcast about Watergate, is out on Tuesday. Get on that. Listen to it. Also, Slate is hiring for a couple of fantastic positions, a staff writer job and a business and technology editor job. You can go to slate.com/jobs to get some more info on those positions. And now for our program. Last week, a Michigan judge sentenced Larry Nassar up to 175 years in prison after hearing statements from more than 150 women who Nassar sexually abused and his roles as a doctor and trainer for USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University. Over the weekend, the Attorney General of Michigan announced that a special prosecutor will launch an investigation into Michigan State and that no individual and no department at the school is off limits. That announcement came shortly after ESPN's Outside the Lines released a story by Paula Levine and Nicole Noren that detailed a history of sexual violence perpetrated by athletes at the school and accusations that Michigan State has shielded athletes from punishment and valued the success of its basketball and football programs over the welfare of women on campus. Joining me now is Paula Levine of ESPN's Outside the Lines. Welcome to the show, Paula.
Thank you very much.
And also with us for this segment is my colleague, Ben Mathis-Lilly, who's been writing about Larry Nassar and Michigan State for Slate. Hey, Ben.
Hi, guys.
Paula, your story covers a huge amount of ground. One of the big takeaways for me was that, and I'm quoting from it, since football coach Mark D'Antonio's tenure began in 2007, at least 16 Michigan State football players have been accused of sexual assault or violence against women, and that complaints involving athletes were routinely investigated and handled by the athletic department rather than other investigative bodies. What stands out to you about what you found in your reporting on Michigan State?
Well, one of the big takeaways is that there was not an acknowledgement of this, that, you know, so much focus has been on Nassar, and deservedly so. I mean, it was so horrible what happened. But to think that anything like that happens in a vacuum is naive. And we're pointing out this was a much bigger problem. It extended into the football program. There were all these cases that were never reached the light of day in the media. And as you can imagine, we're on, day three or four of this, and we're continuing to get calls. And so this is just going to get bigger.
So you guys were on this a couple years ago as part of a larger investigation into sexual assault on campuses around the country, right? In Michigan State.
Okay, yeah,
explain.
It was actually, so back in 2014, we started a story where we wanted to see if student athletes received preferential treatment from the criminal justice system. And that story was focused on all crimes, not specific to sexual assault. Just, you know, when they got busted for, you know, disorderly conduct, were they getting a pass? Another, it was a data-driven story. We sort of looked at prosecution rates and everything. Well, Michigan State was one of 10 universities that we selected for that project. And it was incredibly difficult to get records out of them. They charged us thousands of dollars, dragged their feet for months. And when we finally got our first set of records, we noticed, oh, they've taken every single name out, and which is nothing you could do, which sort of hamstring. They weren't really useful to us at that point. So we sued them. And we went all the way up to the Supreme Court in the state of Michigan. And we ended up winning. Judges ruled that they had to hand over the records and with the names. And so we thought we were good. But that just sort of continued. And earlier this, or last year, last summer, they actually sued us preemptively and trying to defend holding a different set of records. So it's just been this ongoing struggle with them to get information.
Ben, what is your takeaway from the reporting on ESPN?
Well, I wanted to mention something I just saw when I was walking in here, which I think speaks to the points that were made in the ESPN and the Outside the Lines article about the level of influence that Mark D'Antonio and Tom Izzo have at Michigan State, and makes you understand, you know, how something like this might happen. How, you know, and there's a lot we're still learning about it, but how it certainly, when you're looking at it now, it seems like the kind of situation that was set up for this kind of improper influence to be exerted, which is that the Attorney General of Michigan, whose name is Bill Schuette, has announced that he's opening an investigation into Michigan State into their handling of these cases. And in his, I don't know if it was a press conference or a statement, he notes that he vows to investigate D'Antonio just as thoroughly as anyone else, even though D'Antonio wrote the foreword for his book, which came out last year. And, you know, and then the other fact that was going around this morning is that, you know, one of the players described in the piece was serving as an assistant coach for the Michigan State basketball team after having played for Tom Izzo. It was involved in two incidents that Paula's piece describes. There's a piece being sent around from a small newspaper from a few years ago observing that this player actually lived in Tom Izzo's house at the time. This is Travis Walton, who was a player, became an assistant coach, and was involved in two incidents describing the piece. So I can't say I am entirely surprised by having read the piece, although a lot of that information was totally new to me, even as someone who's from Michigan and writes about college sports and follows it. But when you look at those, you look at how powerful Izzo and D'Antonio are in the Michigan State and in the state as a whole, and you see what kind of figures they are, it's in a way, it's not surprising.
Paula, in press conferences over the weekend, both D'Antonio and Izzo began by saying they really want to focus on the victims here. And then when pressed on some of the specifics in your reporting, both kind of fell back on, we always reported things to the authorities, and were just very non-responsive. Is that your take?
Yeah, and somewhat contradictory and a bit confusing. I mean, you know, you mentioned the thing with Travis Walton living in Izzo's basement, and Izzo expresses confusion when he's asked, if Travis Walton left in this summer, I mean, how could you not know about what he did if he was living
like, right. You know,
clearly.
Right. This is yesterday after the game, and he says he didn't remember, right? Is that
right.
What you're referring to? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. He might have a big basement, but I got to think. Common sense would tell you otherwise.
So you wrote a book, Paula, called Violated, Exposing Rape at Baylor University Amid College Football's Sexual Assault Crisis. You've done a huge amount of work at Baylor and at other schools. I'm curious what you think at this relatively early stage of your reporting and our understanding of what's going on at Michigan State, what you see as some of the similarities or differences to what you found at Baylor.
Right. I co-authored that book with my colleague, Mark Schlabaugh. And one thing that he and I found at Baylor that is becoming very apparent at Michigan State is that these are systemic problems. These issues are prevalent in athletic departments, but so much of the handling of this stems from the very top of the university. The leaders who should be the oversight on this, in many cases, end up being the enablers. And that's such a problem. And it's not just Baylor. It's not just Michigan State. This is happening all over the place.
So the president of Michigan State, Lou Anna Simon, resigned last week. The athletic director, Mark Hollis, announced his retirement. So there are already people at extremely high levels at the university who are, out of power because of the Larry Nassar scandal and now this sort of broader scandal. Ben, I'm curious what you think about kind of the focus does seem to be turning to D'Antonio and Tom Izzo. We didn't mention the, horrific allegations against some pretty well-known Michigan State basketball players, Keith Appling and Adrian Payne, around 2010. Do you feel like the focus on D'Antonio and Izzo as just these leading figures of the university and very prominent ones is appropriate now? Or do you feel like that sort of gets us away from understanding that, as Paul said, this is really a systemic problem?
Right. I think there's two sides of that. On one level, I think, of course, that you need to look at, what these gentlemen have done, what Izzo and D'Antonio have done to respond to allegations. You mentioned the Baylor reporting that Paula did, and I was reading some of that this morning. One thing that was striking is just how much there could be to still come out at Michigan State. I mean, the Baylor situation took years to play out. A lot of what was found out about what Art Briles did came very late after he'd been dismissed, when he was involved in a lawsuit and some regents released text messages that, Briles had sent. And that was some of the most damning stuff about the way that he had handled or not handled sexual abuse and assault charges. So, yes, on one level, I think absolutely journalists need to focus on Izzo and D'Antonio because, you know, they are, you know, like we're alluding to, some of the most powerful people at the university. Certainly Hollis and Simon had a role to play also. But obviously everyone knows that the most powerful person at a college campus is usually the coach, and these are two coaches who were very, very successful and had a lot of power. So I absolutely think that the focus on what they did or did not do is appropriate. The side of it that I think is maybe a little premature or beside the point is, you know, it's speculation about whether they're, you know, they're going to get fired or they're going to resign. You know, there were kind of completely fake rumors on last Friday about Izzo resigning. Some writers have read the Outside the Lines report and jumped immediately to saying, well, maybe D'Antonio won't be back next year. And I feel like that, you know, I'm not that it's premature or unfair to them, but it does maybe speak a little bit to the problem in that, you know, immediately we're turning from these very serious criminal issues into, oh, well, you know, well, how will it affect Michigan State's football team?
Yeah, I was going to say, Paula, that kind of, there is the tension there between you want to hold these really powerful people to account. But on the other hand, I think Ben is right that it turns the attention to, like, what'll happen to Michigan State football if Mark D'Antonio is gone?
Right. Yeah, nobody's really saying, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to Michigan State gymnastics, you know, with after right. this? It's right. and the thing that's we appreciate the attention and the focus on our coverage of the football and basketball players, but it is somewhat saddening that you had 150 some young women and it wasn't this explosive story until you involved the football and basketball programs. And that's unfortunate in many ways.
I want to ask you about Lauren Allswede, who is the sexual assault counselor who gives some really powerful testimony in your TV reporting and also in the written pieces that you guys have published. If you know, or if you can say, like, what motivated her to come forward as somebody who was really on the front lines of this and dealing with the victims at Michigan State?
She's really frustrated. She has stayed in contact with some of these women. She's, you know, as the Nassar news broke, she was paying attention to what Michigan State was saying about, you know, its commitment to taking these things seriously and so forth. And she just always felt like the full story hadn't been told. And she's an incredibly strong person. She has stood by everything she said, and she continues to be an advocate and a therapist for sexual assault victims.
And it seemed like she was very angered by what she heard from D'Antonio and Izzo. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think she wrote up this, you know, she heard him saying in his press conference that these, you know, accusations were false, and she was very upset by that. And so she wrote up this long email that she sent to me she wrote it up on Friday, sent it to me on Saturday. It was very powerful and really was sort of saying that the focus should be on them taking responsibility for the tone that they set in the department. And she talks about how, you know, why when she was there and they had all these workshops, you know, why why didn't she meet with them? And the fact that she didn't meet with them, that was a problem. So she had a pretty strong response to him saying that.
I have a deep question about Alsweed and D'Antonio. The allegation that was made in the article is that he at one point handled a report of assault directly, and that's what he denied, and that's what seems to have upset her. I was wondering if there's anything more you can say about that allegation. I mean, I believe this is the incident in which he was said to have talked to the player's mother or asked the player to tell his mother what he'd done, and that was considered an adequate discipline. Am I right in remembering that?
Right, and what he says, so here's exactly what he said. He said that he was here, he says, I'm here tonight to say that any accusations of my handling of any complaints of sexual assault individually are completely false. And individually is one of those, you could say, hedge words, right? So in our story, you know, we indicated he had a role in handling this. It's unclear how much of a role he had. That information came to Lauren Alsweed from somebody else with the university, so clearly other people were aware of it.
Right.
This is one of those things where it's the devil is in the details, and exactly, you know, did he have the final say on it? Did he report it? But then this was what people agreed was okay. That's the question.
Paula Levine is with ESPN's Outside the Lines. We will link to her reporting on our show page. You should definitely check it out, and we look forward to seeing what else you have on this story, Paula. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Great. Thank you.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Before we get to the Australian Open, I want to let you know about our bonus segment for Slate Plus members. In a little bit, we're going to talk to Damon Young about the NBA All-Star Draft. We're going to have Damon stick around a little bit to talk more NBA and the concept of Warriors derangement syndrome. If you want to hear that, join Slate Plus. It's just $35 a year. If you do it, you can get bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week. Sign up at slate.com/hangupplus. On Sunday in Melbourne, Australia, Roger Federer beat Marin Cilic in five sets, 6-2, 6-7, 6-3, 3-6, 6-1, to win his sixth Australian Open title, his second Aussie Open in a row, his third Grand Slam in his last four starts, and his 20th overall Grand Slam title, extending his all-time mark for men's singles and getting him within three of Serena Williams. Meanwhile, on the women's side, friend of Serena, Caroline Wozniacki, won her first Grand Slam ever and ascended to number one in the world by outlasting Simona Halep, 7-6, 3-6, 6-4, in a grueling 2-hour and 50-minute final. Joining me now is tennis writer and aficionado Howard Bryant. Howard is a columnist for ESPN the magazine, and he's also the author of the upcoming book, The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism, now available for pre-order. How's it going, Howard?
It's going great now that I know that I can go to bed and not have to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch tennis.
Yeah, how is your Aussie Open schedule? Do you DVR or do you watch live?
No, I watch it live. I can't do the DVR. I think one of my favorite things in the world, though, I have to say, when I've got to get my son up and get him ready for school, is to get up at 6:15 and still see like we're in the fourth set of a match that I fell asleep on with all the lights on.
There's this sort of like magical feeling, like you're kind of, I don't know how to describe it. It's like you're by yourself in the dark watching like this event happen halfway around the world in the bright sunshine. It feels like it's happening in an alternate universe.
In the summertime, absolutely. And it's 95, 105 degrees out there.
So we are in the alternate universe of Caroline Wozniacki having now won a Grand Slam title in her 43rd appearance in a Grand Slam tournament. And it wasn't even just in Grand Slam Tower. Like, she's had trouble closing out tournaments, like losing in a bunch of finals. And she like really, really earned this title, which was great to see. It was an unbelievable battle against another player, Halep, who had come up short repeatedly in Grand Slams. What did you make of that match?
I make a lot out of the entire Fortnite, to be honest, when it comes to those two players. And that I think one thing that we don't appreciate enough, and I think it's simply a byproduct of maybe they make it look too easy, or maybe because we're too detached because it's our entertainment, it's in their life. But it's how hard it is to win. And when you watch players, and especially tennis, because you have to be on a winning streak to win a tennis tournament.
Yeah.
It's similar to the playoffs. It's similar to the football playoffs in that you can't lose. The baseball playoffs, you can win, you know, if you've got home field, you can win every other game and win the championship and really not ever have to win two games in a row. If you've got home field and you win the first game, you just keep winning every other game. But in tennis, in a major, you got to win seven straight. And it's difficult to win seven straight matches at any time during the season. It's incredibly difficult to win seven straight matches at a Grand Slam because of all the heightened pressure and all of that comes with it. And when I think about a player like Caroline Wozniacki, I've been up and down on Wozniacki. I was not a fan of hers when she was the world number one before Serena, when Serena was hurt and before Serena came back and decided to tear the tennis world to pieces. And part of the reason was I thought she was young and a little immature and a little arrogant. And I think she thought it came a little bit too easy. And I remember, you know, I used to refer to her as the paper tiger. And part of that reason was because she didn't hit winners. She didn't win Grand Slam. She didn't go deep into tournaments, even though she did go to one final. But there were always players out there that could challenge her. And yet, statistically, she was the world number one because she won the most matches and she won the most points. But there's a big difference between being the world number one and being the best player in the world.
Yeah, the fascinating thing about her is that I think where it turned around was when she was training for the New York Marathon. You remember that a few years ago?
Oh, yeah.
And so many people criticized her and said it was really stupid because you don't need to have that kind of training to play well on a tennis court, which maybe seems wrong, but this is what we were hearing about her, and also that she was doing all these photo shoots. You know, she's in the swimsuit issue.
Yeah, that she'd gone Hollywood, and let's not forget the Rory McIlroy stuff, and let's not forget the J.J. Watt stuff, and let's not. And now it's all of that just feels like noise. But I had always disagreed with this, with the marathon criticism, because I think that one thing that running a marathon and training for a marathon also gives you. Do you have to be that fit to be in a tennis court? No, but it gives you a mental toughness. It gives you a mental fitness.
Right.
If you can conquer 26.2, you can conquer three sets, and you can remind yourself that you've got the fortitude to come through.
Yeah, that's the point that I was going to make. And also, I felt like this was after the Rory McIlroy thing, when she had become tabloid fodder and had kind of, you know, she'd been jilted and had become like, not necessarily a laughing stock, but she was known for something that she didn't really want to be known for. It struck me, and maybe this is a little bit psych 101, but she was taking control of her life, doing a thing that she wanted to do, doing a thing that, as you said, required great mental toughness. I mean, even when, as you said, she was the paper tiger, like in 2009, there was this tournament in Doha where she went into these full body cramps. I don't know if you've seen that video. It's like the most shocking kind of on-court injury I've really ever seen. She's just on the ground, like kind of flailing around like an eel.
Sure.
It's horrible to watch. And she ended up winning that match. I mean, this has always been a woman who's tough, despite maybe appearances and despite reputation. But it seems like she's combined that with maybe finding a joy in the game and doing what it is that she wants to do and not listening to other people. And it's all finally come together for her, plus Serena's out.
And plus Serena's out. And by the way, even if she hadn't won, that's also true.
Yes.
You know, because you don't have to win a championship to take control of your life. You don't have to win to be, you know, to fulfill some of those things that we're talking about.
Yes.
And I think that we spend a lot of time only paying attention to those things when it happens, you know, when you actually finally hold up the big hardware, when you're holding up Daphne wherever you go. And so I think that I think that Caroline Wozniacki is a great testament to how hard it is to play these games. I mean, let's not forget, for all we're talking about Maria Sharapova, and she hasn't come back yet. I mean, she got demolished by Angelique Kerber in Melbourne. And when you start looking at Sloane Stephens goes out and wins a Grand Slam and she can't win a match now. She just won the U.S. Open 4 months ago and she can't win a match now. And so it's a difficult thing to do. And I think that she proved how badly she wanted to win it, how hard she was willing to work, that she was willing to put the miles in to do it. She was willing to deal with the disappointments. And speaking of disappointments, you look at someone like Simona Halep and you wonder how much more disappointment she can handle. She is moving into that space that nobody wants.
The thing about Wozniacki and Halep is that it's never going to be easy for them. Not that it's easy for anyone to win a title, but Serena or Pliskova or Keys or Vandeweghe, they have amazing serves and forehands and they can win easy points. If
That's
you watched this women's final, there weren't any, you know, free points to be had on that court.
No, and especially that point was even more apparent in the Kerber-Halep match where neither one of them were getting anything with their serve. They needed 16, 17 shots to win a point, and eventually that will break you.
Let's move on to the men, where for most of the way, Roger Federer seemed like he was in total control. And the next thing you know, Marin Cilic has a point to go up a break in the fifth set. Federer ended up holding onto his serve there, and he eventually ran away with the final set 6-1, and he won the title. But there were some nervous moments there. Howard, I want to play this clip of Federer doing a post-match interview with Australian television. I found this fascinating because earlier in his career, when he was winning three majors a year, Federer was known as being kind of hilariously cocky, talking in a really matter-of-fact way about how great he was. But that is not how he sounds here. Let's listen.
I got off a flyer, which was great, but then that made me think of, what if I won? My God, that'd be so cool. Then I had my chances, Marin played well, and then I just think I froze in the tiebreaker, and at the end of the second, I just think I got really nervous, and I think that's why I lost that second set and couldn't take control of the match, really. And then it got a match, and it got tight, and I think Marin helped me out in the third and in the fifth to stretch the lead a little bit, so I got a little bit lucky tonight, I think.
So that's humanizing, right, Howard? It's a reminder that even the greatest player of all time gets nervous. But are you surprised to hear Federer talk that way?
Well, once again, what were we talking about earlier about how hard it is to win? And I think the players start to recognize, especially when you start aging, that maybe it's not going to come back around for me. Maybe it's not going to happen for me, even though I'm Roger Federer. I mean, let's remember that Roger went 5 years between majors. He won number seven. I was there when he won 17, when he beat Andy Murray at Wimbledon in 2012, and then didn't win another major until 2017. And so when you start looking at that, I think he knows. And when you have these great comebacks, or when you have those droughts, you have an appreciation for the game because it is slipping away. And when you're 25, it doesn't feel like it'll slip away. You feel like there's some way that I'm going to be different from everybody else. The one thing we know about sports is that age is undefeated. Time is undefeated. Time never loses.
Tennis Sandgren, amazing underdog story, transformed into not that in record time. When people started looking at his Twitter feed, he retweeted a guy named Nicholas Fuentes, who was a white nationalist who was prominent in the Charlottesville rally. He also tweeted things himself about how Pizzagate was sickening. He wrote about Hillary Clinton's involvement in satanic rituals. He wrote in 2012 that he'd stumbled into a gay club and his eyes were bleeding. It was a rather remarkable Twitter feed, Howard. What did you think about Tennis Sandgren's run and the discovery of his social media output and his response to it?
Well, if you follow Tennis Sandgren, what he said on Twitter is not surprising at all, because he's been saying this for years. The problem is that he's not been any good and nobody was paying attention to what he was saying. It's a lot of what he said. It bothered me only because it didn't bother me because he said it, because he is who he is. And I don't feel like I'm responsible for his rehabilitation simply because he won a Grand Slam match. I didn't care for him. I don't care for him.
I have no interest in following him. And I think one of the very interesting things that we do in this sport, and it drives me crazy in terms of the coverage of the sport, is we treat tennis like it's the Olympics. We have a great tradition of American tennis, therefore we can't let this go. It's like being a Yankee fan or a Boston Celtics fan or a Montreal Canadiens fan. You've got this history that you built the sport. So therefore, we're always going to go nuts on American tennis. We're always going to try to talk about American tennis as if it requires more than what it's produced over the last few years, talking about the men.
I have a bunch of thoughts here. The first is that I think, you know, we can give people the benefit of the doubt, but I think it's really important before we do that to be very clear about what it is that we're talking about and what it is that he has said and that he's done. Because in this case, I felt very strongly that because of what he did was on social media, that it was treated by some people like it wasn't real, or it was treated by some people like he was just dishonest about what he had said and what he had done.
Absolutely. Couldn't have been more real.
People just rolled with it. He claimed that it was, oh, I just follow certain people on Twitter and mm-hmm, I follow mm-hmm. people because I'm interested. I'm like a seeker and I want people to...
Yeah, I'm a seeker of truth. I just want to figure things out and learn from people, which is completely not true. And Josh, you bring up a really, really good point too, which is treating it like it's not real. It actually couldn't be more real, but I always think about this in terms of the why. Why are we doing this to Tennis Sandgren? Because Tennis Sandgren is an American, and we are being forced to care about him. Well, you know what? I like the athletes that I like, and tennis is a very special sport in this regard, that it's a very nationalistic sport. And because of it, you watch a tennis tournament on ESPN, and what do they talk about? Americans left in the draw. How many Americans are left? This is the first American to do this. I don't care about that, to be honest. And I think this is where we ran into a journalistic coverage trap. He's an American, so therefore we're going to treat this like it's not real because he's messing with the feel-good story. And that's the battle that we were in. We were kind of caught in that trap of, okay, here's a guy who's got a great underdog story. However, he's no hero, and he's not somebody that is going to be easy for you to root for.
So Chris Fowler said on ESPN towards the tail end of his match with Chung and sort of trying to like wrap up this guy's tournament, Fowler said he's a thoughtful guy. And if you want to characterize people with labels, clickbait headlines, I'd caution you to just be a little bit careful and get to know something more about somebody, which I found very interesting because here was the Tennis Sandgren progression during the tournament. So the first press conference he has when somebody asks him about his tweets, his response was, don't infer what I believe from my tweets. Just ask me what I think and I'd be happy to tell you. Then the next day he says, I'm a Christian and I believe in the teachings of Christ. And also I'm going to delete all of my tweets. So you can't even see what I believe. And I'm just going to say I'm a Christian.
And also the public doesn't have the opportunity to go ask you directly what you think. You sent this out there. And I thought what Chris Fowler said, I thought that was the most egregious comment of the whole tournament. It's like, are you going to tell me that you know this guy? Are you riding with this? Or once again, are you riding with the narrative because you don't want to deal with how difficult and how murky this really is? Is this the hill you want to die on? Because I don't think that what Tennis Sandgren has done was very defensible at all.
And then the last point in this progression that I wanted to make was, so he first goes, just ask me what I believe. Then he says, I'm a Christian. Then the last thing, he goes to his press conference after his final match, and he reads this statement off his phone, and we can play some of that in a second. But the basic point of that statement was, actually, don't ask me what I believe. Don't ask me about anything. Just ask me about the tennis match. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
You seek to put people in these little boxes so that you can order the world in your already assumed preconceived ideas. You strip away any individuality for the sake of demonizing by way of the collective. With a handful of follows and some likes on Twitter, my fate has been sealed in your minds. To write an edgy story, to create sensationalist coverage, there are few lengths you wouldn't go to mark me as the man you desperately want me to be. You would rather perpetuate propaganda machines instead of researching information from a host of angles and perspectives, while being willing to learn, change, and grow. You dehumanize with pen and paper and turn neighbor against neighbor. In so doing, you may actually find you're hastening the hell you wish to avoid. The hell we all wish to avoid.
This might sound unduly harsh, Howard, but when I listen to that statement that he made, what I hear is somebody who, I don't know if it's like that they're not that worldly. It's like somebody who thinks that they're smarter than they are.
Tennis Sandgren got exposed, and I'll just leave it at that.
Howard Bryant is a writer for ESPN. He is also the author of the upcoming book, The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. Thanks so much, Howard.
Oh, my pleasure. Call anytime.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Last Thursday, with no TV cameras anywhere in sight, leading all-star vote-getters and team captains LeBron James and Steph Curry picked their rosters for the 2018 All-Star Game via conference call. What we know for certain is that LeBron took Kevin Durant with his first pick. What we also know for certain, and LeBron agrees, is that this thing should have been televised.
Hey, I'm going to tell you this, Ernie. This thing should have been televised. And when me and Steph was doing the draft, we started laughing very hard at one point. I'm not even going to tell you what part it was, but we started laughing very hard at one point. It definitely should have been televised, well, that's for sure.
We will never know why they were laughing. We do know also that Russell Westbrook thought he got picked last. Listen to this locker room interview in which Carmelo Anthony is egging him on in the background. This is amazing.
Thoughts on being picked by LeBron for the All-Star team?
Oh, that's cool, man. That's good, man. Finally, they got the team figured out.
Tell me how you really feel.
But I see I was the last pick on the list. I was just trying to figure out, you know.
Alphabetical.
It was alphabetical.
See, I told you, man. Alphabetical order, man. Of course I was first. Of course. What are you talking about?
Joining us now is Damon Young of The Root, who is my first pick to talk about the NBA's first annual All-Star Conference call. How's it going, Damon?
I feel good. I feel like Kevin Durant.
You should. You should be extremely honored. I think, you know, the fact that LeBron and Steph were kind of teasing us and talking about how fun it was a little bit of an enticement. But the fact that Russ was just like pretending that he was cool with it, also wearing like that yellow shirt with holes in it that he rocked last week as a typical Westbrookian fashion statement. But the fact that he was pretending that everything was hunky-dory, and then when he finds out that he wasn't actually the last pick, just starts yelling at Carmelo, that I think is the proof that we needed, that we need to know the draft order. We need to have this on television because people have so many feelings about this.
Yeah, and the thing is, I mean, these, you know, although they're all NBA All-Stars and all millionaires and superstars or whatever, these are also like hypersensitive men, athletes who take every slight personally. And so, yeah, it would have been awesome just to see the drama of, you know, oh, DeRozan, because according to this list, DeRozan went last. So is he going to come out and, you know, try to get 50 in an All-Star game to prove that he shouldn't have gone last in the starters draft? And so, yeah, that would have been, I still think the draft itself is just a really cool idea. I'm not that disappointed that it wasn't televised. It's almost like you order a sundae and the sundae doesn't come with a cherry. I feel like the right. Televised part would have been a cherry.
Right.
But I'm happy that I got a sundae.
It was just so perfect that the supposed draft order comes out. It was actually just like LeBron tweeting out the list of everyone he had picked in alphabetical order. And John Wall is right in front of Westbrook. And the Wizards are playing the Thunder that night. Westbrook goes out and scores 46 to prove to everyone that he's better than John Wall. He actually just proved to everyone that Westbrook is behind Wall in alphabetical order. But just as you said, everything is better in the NBA when people have chips on their shoulders and people have something to prove. And this is like a totally harmless way to get people mad at each other.
Yeah, and I'm actually glad that your podcast draft wasn't, wasn't televised or was no list out, because with my last name, I would have had an issue, because I would have been listed last and I would have came on here screaming and calling you all types of MFs and everything just to prove that, you know, I needed to be the first guest, the first choice. But and this thing, you know, with the All-Star game, even though, you know, I think that often we treat it as like this meaningless exhibition, and sometimes the players play like it is. It matters a lot to them. It matters a whole lot. You know, there's a story about that I was just reading about the All-Star game in 90 or 91 when AC Green was voted ahead of Carmelo as a starter. And then the next night, Carmelo goes out and gets 61 in like 33 minutes. I don't think they were playing the Lakers, but he was just, you know, doing that to prove a point. And it's funny how you see
the non-controversial point that Karl Malone is better than AC Green.
Yeah. Andre Drummond had like, you know, 30 points, 25 rebounds, and I don't know how many blocks when found out he wasn't on All-Star team. Ben Simmons had a triple-double in like 7 minutes or something crazy like that. I mean, and you think, if you have like this in you, why not do that like all the time, Andre Drummond?
That's a good point. We've got to piss Andre Drummond off just as like a national project.
Yeah,
we just need to just always be making Andre Drummond angry. Let's go through the draft order. So this is per Jackie McMullen. She announced this per her sources, the legend Jackie McMullen, on the ESPN show Around the Horn. So this is the first time ever that the ESPN show Around the Horn has ever been useful. So we have that. Here is, according to Jackie McMullen, the way that things went. So LeBron James had the first pick because he had the most votes and he is the captain of one of the teams. And he went with Kevin Durant. Then Steph had the second pick and he picked Giannis Antetokounmpo from the Bucks. And I think, Damon, this is the first interesting choice because he went with Giannis over Anthony Davis, who LeBron took next. What do you think about this idea, I guess, at least in Stephen Curry's mind, that Giannis is better than Anthony Davis?
I think in a format like this, he is, because in an All-Star game, you know, you want a guy like LeBron, like Durant, like John, like Giannis, who's going to get a rebound and go coast to coast like that. Because no one, you know, especially in the first two quarters, though, that's when those type of guys really like get their stats up. And you want to have a guy that could just get the ball and go and not need an outlet, because those are the guys that function the best in All-Star games. And so in this format, I think he's better. I think he's better than Anthony Davis, just without the All-Star game. Anyway, I would choose him before I chose Anthony Davis.
Controversial.
It's like splitting hairs with me, but I would, gun to my head, pick Giannis. But yeah, I think that in this format, he would be more effective because, you know, Davis is more of a finisher.
Yeah, and Giannis would be a really fun guy to play with.
Yeah.
And an All-Star game.
You want a guy who can finish and who can also start to break himself.
Anthony Davis is amazing, though. All right. So after that, Steph picked James Harden, which led to the fascinating phenomenon of LeBron choosing Kyrie Irving. Do you feel like LeBron took Kyrie because he was the best player on the board, and so obviously you're going to want to pick the best team, so you're going to take Kyrie? Do you think that he did it because he actively wanted Kyrie on his team? Do you think he did it to make people think that he and Kyrie were cool? Like, there are a lot of potential theories here.
I think all of those answers are right. Like, at the exact same time, there's quite a bit of overlap there. I'm looking at the draft board right now, the list, and it went pretty much how I think you would expect it to go, even without any sort of like personal histories or context. I mean, maybe you switch Giannis and Anthony Davis. Maybe, you know, maybe you switch Harden or Kyrie. I don't know. But for an all-star game, not a regular NBA season, regular season game, but I think this is the order that it should have gone. And, you know, Steph and Kyrie, there's too much duplication there. So it's obvious why Steph wouldn't pick him. So I think that, I think that he landed right where he's supposed to land. And yes, you know, LeBron probably wanted to, you know, do this big show of like this performative magnanimity, like, you know, I'm the bigger person. There's no feud here. I'm not the one who pushed Kyrie out. I'm just letting everyone know that. And I'm going to pick him on my team. And during that game, they're going to be hugging. They're going to be patting each other's heads. You know, they might even have a pat off like they did the first game of the season where they just kept. It was almost like this, I don't know, like a shoot off or something. Like,
they didn't want to be the first one to stop patting.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if they just stood at half court, just did that for 5 minutes.
I guess if but you're exactly right. Like, the draft went kind of according to how you or I would do it, just without any kind of considerations of, I don't want to be with this guy, just based on talent and based on team fit. And so I think ultimately, if LeBron hadn't picked Kyrie there, it would have been obvious that he was actively avoiding taking him. And so it might have been less of a proactive, I want Kyrie on my team, and more of like, it'll be a storyline if I don't take him here.
Mm-hmm. And I also think, you know, the day of the draft, when these picks were leaked out, and there was a lot of criticism over Steph's starting lineup. Basically, people just asking him, was he blind, or did he lose a bet or something, the team that he picked. But in an all-star game, I might rather have DeMar DeRozan than DeMarcus Cousins, you know, in an up and down type of game. Because, I mean, neither of them are going to be guarding or playing defense anyway. So I'll take the guy that can handle the ball a bit more, that can shoot better in a situation like that. So, you know, I think LeBron's team, you know, without the Cousins injury, obviously is a better regular season NBA team. But for an all-star game type of game, you know, I don't think they're that uneven, at least the starters.
Okay, so I think it's important here, and it does seem like it's going to be televised next year. And also, you know, we shouldn't necessarily lump together, like, they also just didn't release the draft order. So almost like being televised is a bit like a red herring. Like, it would be really fun to watch them do the draft live, and I would definitely watch that. But, you know, they could have released the order and not televised it. So I think, you know, next year they will release the draft order, they will televise it. But it's really important that you have two guys in Steph and LeBron who, like, are totally secure in terms of their reputations, in terms of their legacies, and just, like, don't give a shit. And so, you know, LeBron has Westbrook and Durant on his team. He also has Kyrie on his team. It doesn't seem like they were really shying away from, you know, making picks that would be uncomfortable or controversial, which makes it a lot more fun. Steph did pick, like, all of his teammates that he could possibly pick. Like, he, based on the leaked order, it looked like he took Klay Thompson and Draymond Green with his first two picks among the reserves. It would have been, admittedly, a lot more fun if he just, like, refused to take those guys and then made them pissed off and the Warriors season fell apart. But I guess that's not really a possibility.
Well, you know, I'm going to push back a little bit on what you just said, because I do think LeBron is not securing his legacy right now. And he does care. I don't think Steph cares as much about something like this, but I think LeBron, as hyper sensitive as he is to how he's perceived and social media and just how people regard him and assess what he does, I definitely think that he put a lot of thought into it. And now, even without the thought, his picks are still picks that are natural picks. You know, he didn't pick DeMar DeRozan first. I mean, I keep harping on DeMar DeRozan, but, you know, he's a great player. But he didn't pick him first. He picked exactly how, again, I think he should have picked.
I think it's possible. Like, there's a universe in which there could have been some horse trading and LeBron, like, let Steph take Durant. Like, that could have happened. And I think it's a credit to them that they didn't do that. Maybe that's like a low bar, but like obviously you're going to pick Durant first. And if LeBron doesn't take Durant first, then the whole thing is pointless, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that, you know, I forgot who, but someone joked on Twitter that, you know, he got him and Kyrie on the same team and Russ and Durant, you know, who knows, he might've been able to get Tupac and Biggie in the same booth. You know, if he's this type of diplomat. And so, yeah, I think LeBron cares about that type of stuff a little bit more than Steph probably does. Because, again, you know, he is still concerned about, you know, his place in that whole, I guess, top five or top three or whatever NBA pantheon. And so these things matter to him.
All right, last thought on this before we move on to the Cavs. We've talked about poor DeMar DeRozan being the last of the starters to get picked. And based on the reports we've seen, USA Today had the full draft order. They had the last pick in the whole draft among the reserves as LaMarcus Aldridge, which is perfect, right? Like, out of this list of people, LaMarcus Aldridge is somebody who, like DeRozan, is just an amazing player, great player. But out of this list, like, LaMarcus Aldridge is the guy that you're going to pick last. He's not somebody that you want to watch in the All-Star game. He's somebody who's kind of come up a little bit small in the playoffs before, like with the Spurs. He hasn't been like, he's obviously an All-Star, but he's just like not somebody you can necessarily count on. Like, LaMarcus Aldridge is the perfect last guy to pick in the All-Star draft.
Oh, I agree. I mean, there's guys like that in All-Star game every year where, you know, they obviously deserve to be there because of their accomplishments during the season. But then they get into the game and you're like, why are they on the court? Can someone please sub this person out? Like, Paul Millsap is the all-time. It's like on a Mount Rushmore of like
the Al Horford regular too, right?
Season, you know, the All-Star resume, but totally definitely does not belong in the game at all.
Al Horford, yeah. Right? He was the second to last pick.
Another one. Al Horford's another one. You know, DeRozan, you know, Kevin Love, there's a guy that I don't need to see him on the court at all in the All-Star game.
Kevin Love predicted that he was going to be the last pick, but LeBron took him rather early, I think, again, for like locker room harmony purposes.
Yeah, you know, and LeBron, you know, he's always thinking he wants to get, you know, kind of like with Hillary trying to get what was his running mate, Tim Kaine. So he's trying to get like the white vote. So he makes sure that he gets like the one of the only American white player on his team. So, you know, LeBron, again, he's always thinking politically.
All right. So the Cavs beat the Pistons on Sunday night, which is like noteworthy that the Cavs won a game. Congratulations. That's huge for them.
It is.
Coach Tyronn Lue did not play Isaiah Thomas in the fourth quarter. He says that he wants to not always have LeBron and Isaiah on the court at the same time. This team has major issues on the court and off the court. They're second to last in the league in defensive rating. They're fighting it out with the Sacramento Kings, which when you're doing that, you might as well just be dead last. And they had this huge beef in the locker room where people were accusing Kevin Love of like not really being sick when he came out of the game. People are saying that Isaiah is shooting too much. There was the whole weird anonymous press conference where these Cavs players talked to reporters from ESPN and The Athletic and the Cleveland paper and basically said, our team is bad. this doesn't seem like the usual Cavs drama. This seems worse.
And you know, we say that every year.
But it has to be worse, like, sometimes. I even if you say it all the time, sometimes one time it's going to be worse.
I know, but I'm not underselling the Cavs drama, but I am still hesitant to really I'm hesitant to really put too much meaning behind it, because again, we every year since LeBron has been back in Cleveland, this has been like right before the All-Star break, the Cavs, you know, there's something wrong with them. And then around the All-Star game or after the All-Star game, they go on this run and they end up, you know, being a team that looks like they could at least get to the finals. And I think that they're much worse this year. Like, I think that they Isaiah Thomas, just even healthy, I don't think is a good replacement for Kyrie. And, you know, a guy like Jay Crowder is a guy that I feel like this happens with NBA media sometimes, where they might look at a guy like, you know, and I'm going to say this, they look at a black guy with dreadlocks and assume that he's a lot tougher and more athletic than he actually is, just because of like how he looks and he has the tattoos. Like, oh, he must be athletic, he must be strong, he must be tough. And Jay Crowder is a guy that runs from three-point line to three-point line right now.
And he's not making threes. I have no comment on his toughness, but he's not making threes.
Yeah, he has these muscles. You know, he should go trial for tight end or something, you know. And I'm not surprised, though, by the issues that the Cavs are having this year. You know, Isaiah Thomas is a guy that, although he is a great player, and had one of probably the all-time great seasons for a guard ever last year. But he is also a guy, if you follow his career, there have always been locker room rumblings wherever he's been. You know, in Sacramento, they existed. In Phoenix, they existed. In Boston, they existed. And he's a guy that, if he is not like your alpha main, you know, superstar guy, is going to make things a little difficult, and which is understandable, because, you know, a guy at his size being as good as he is, you just have to always have a chip on your shoulder. You always have to be a bit of a dick. And
you also have to be physically like your absolute 100% best to be able to succeed at the NBA, given his body type, his size. And he's just not that. And he doesn't adjust his game based on not being physically right. He still shoots the ball like every time he has it in his hands, and he's bad defensively. Like, I was watching the Spurs Cavs game last week, and it is just, I mean, the numbers don't lie in this case. It is just unbelievable how bad they are defensively. Like, Derrick Rose doesn't play that much, but when he was in the game, he was like operating in an alternate universe in which defense is illegal. Like, he is just it's unreal how bad he is and how he just loses his man. And so, you know, if you watched any of the Celtics Warriors game on Saturday, like, the Celtics are 1-1 against the Warriors now this year. They split the season series. That game came down to the last seconds. The Celtics are the best defense in the league. They compete really, really hard. And if you watch that compared to the Cavs going up against the Warriors, I mean, it's no contest.
Yeah. Yeah, the Celtics match up much better with the Warriors.
Maybe the Cavs can still beat the Celtics, but the Celtics would be a better matchup against the Warriors. I don't know.
I agree. I think that this Cavs team would get swept. And an easy sweep by the Warriors, whereas I think I think the Celtics can dirty the game up a bit against them, especially, you know, they with Marcus Smart out there too, doing Marcus Smart shit. I believe that they, you know, can make things a lot more uncomfortable for them than the Cavs would, and that's how you beat the Warriors, is you make things uncomfortable, you know, for 3.5 quarters, and then you hope you have a guy that can you know, match or outmatch Steph and Durant in those last like 6 minutes. And, you know, the Celtics have a guy like that, you know, that could get hot and, you know, a 7-game series and, you know, maybe win a couple. And the Cavs just don't have enough guys to dirty the game up. If they are to compete with the Warriors, they would have to outscore them, and they're not going to outscore the Warriors. They just don't have that type of firepower.
We should wrap this up, although I do want to mention we would be remiss not to note the amazing story, which Kyrie Irving has refuted, but Cleveland.com had a report that one of the reasons that Kyrie ended up getting traded, because people have been like, why didn't they just keep him? You know, he was under contract. Apparently, he threatened to get knee surgery if they didn't trade him. I'm imagining him like walking into the GM's office just with a scalpel, like hovering over his knee. It's like, if you don't trade me, I'm gonna slice in here. Again, he's refuted it, but that's probably true.
I mean, that's just tells you how crazy things are in Cleveland, where a story as ridiculous as that, like a player in his prime of his career would risk going under the knife to you know, his already surgically repaired knee, would risk that rather than
I've done it before, man. You know, I'll do it again.
Yeah. Like that's, and again, the fact, I don't believe it, but the fact that that was an actual story that came out of Cleveland and people believed it just lets you know how dire things are in that locker room right now.
Damon Young is a writer for The Root. Always fun to have you, Damon. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for After Balls. I did not get around to mentioning it in our segment just completed about the NBA All-Star Game, but there was an NHL equivalent of this draft in 2012. The NHL doesn't do it anymore, but back then they did this thing where players got picked and there was a last guy picked, and it was Logan Couture. He played for the Sharks. And there was a consolation prize that the NHL gave. Logan Couture got a brand new Honda Crosstour vehicle. He was asked if he would be cool with being the last pick if he got a car. He said, maybe. What kind of car is it? It's unclear if he thought that a Honda Crosstour was worth it to be the last guy picked, if that was enough of an enticement to make him feel less sad. But, you know, possibility for the NBA, make the last pick feel good about himself, give the dude a car. So we will honor Logan Couture. Here is my Logan Couture. Over the weekend in San Diego, Tiger Woods finished 72 holes in a PGA Tour event for the first time in more than 2 years. Although he couldn't hit the ball straight off the tee, he did manage to shoot par or better all 4 rounds and finish in the top 30, which is pretty damn impressive considering the dude had spinal fusion surgery in April and could not swing at all for 6 months. Tiger has had pretty serious back issues for a long time now, but back in November, a Hang Up listener named Matt Shaw made me aware of a golfer whose health problems were way, way more severe. It is a crazy story, which I will tell you now. Ebenezer McBurney Byers, known as Eben for short, won the U.S. Amateur in 1906. In its write-up of Byers' triumph, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch noted that those who love a good sportsman and high-class performer will be very glad that at last the golf championship of the United States has fallen to Mr. Eben Byers of Pittsburgh. Upon one occasion, he was beaten for the title by a huge fluke when Lewis James, a third-class man, happened to be playing a first-class game of golf. That is kind of rude to Lewis James. We're going to put that aside for the rest of this after ball. We're going to talk about Eben Byers. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch went on to praise him for his consistency, his pertinacity, his fine spirit in losing, and modesty and victory. He was courageous. He was well-tempered. He persevered. And triumph came, as it always does, to those who try and who wait. Byers' fortune, though, turned out for the worse a few decades later. The story of his untimely death is told in a 1990 article written by Ron Winslow, published in the Wall Street Journal, under the memorable headline, "The radium water worked fine until his jaw came off." That story began in 1927. A steel mogul and socialite named Eben McBurney Byers tumbled from the top berth of his private Pullman compartment en route home to New York from the Harvard-Yale football game. He was apparently engaged in some vigorous post-game revelry at the time. What happened next led ultimately to his gruesome death. The cause of his gruesome death was radium poisoning, which Byers acquired by drinking a patent medicine called Radithor that was marketed as, among other things, an aphrodisiac, with promises that improved blood supply sent to the pelvic organs and tonic effects upon the nervous system generally result in a great improvement in the sex organs. Byers was reportedly taking the medicine, gulping 2 or 3 bottles a day because he'd hurt his arm while falling out of that train berth. Radithor was, per the Wall Street Journal, nothing more than distilled water laced with radium, and Byers sent cases of it to business partners and girlfriends and even fed it to his racehorses. Those poor horses. After 2 years of feeling good on Radithor, Byers started to lose weight and get headaches. By 1931, his whole upper jaw, excepting 2 front teeth, and most of his lower jaw had been removed, while all the remaining bone tissue of his body was disintegrating and holes were forming in his skull. In March 1932, Byers died of radium poisoning in a New York City hospital. Roger M. Maclis, a radiation oncologist, wrote a journal article about Byers in 1990. Maclis had managed to track down some bottles of Radithor from an antiques dealer, and he figured out that Byers had ingested enough radium to kill 4 people. But you'll recall that Byers was feeling good for 2 years before he got sick. Maclis speculated that it is possible that chronic low-level doses of powerful alpha radiation do have at least a temporary stimulative effect, probably by provoking a defensive response that triggers production of fresh blood cells within the bone marrow. But please, I beg of you, do not try Radithor at home. The stimulant effect, it is not worth it. Trust me. No Radithor. Don't do it. That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Ford, and our intern is Jason Rosenzweig. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. And you can email us at hangup@slate.com. You should also check out the Political Gabfest. Stars the legendary Emily Bazelon, the immortal John Dickerson, and America's sweetheart, David Plotz. Voted favorite political podcast by iTunes listeners, Stephen Colbert says everybody should listen to the Slate Political Gabfest. Do not defy Stephen Colbert. Go to slate.com/gabfest to get your weekly fix. Thanks to all of our guests this week, Paula Levine, Ben Mathis Lilly, Howard Bryant, and Damon Young. I am Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.